Mark Caro, and welcome to episode 198 of Caro Pop. If you'd like to support us, as Mike Trutinich just did, please go to caropop.com. Immediately before this conversation, I was inside Chicago's Goodman Theater, seeing the final preview of a new punk metal hip-hop musical, Revolutions, with parentheses around the S. Sitting in front of me was Tom Morello, whom you must know as the mind-bending, paint-peeling guitarist-songwriter of Rage Against the Machine, Audioslave, Bruce Springsteen collaborations, and so much more. Morello wrote the music for this show, which was set to have its official premiere the following night, and he was scribbling notes from his seat, that is, when he wasn't banging his head and body back and forth to the song's hard beats. This is the rare musical that hands out earplugs with your playbill. After the show, the two of us, plus Caro Pop producer Chris Swake, retreated to an upstairs rehearsal room where Morello and I dug into his three decades of politically charged music making. Some of the songs in Revolutions were plucked from the 22 albums he has recorded, whether in his Night Watchman, Protest Folk Singer guys, or other projects. In my hands, I hold the proof. Whatever it takes. You won't hear Rage Against the Machine songs or other relatively famous tunes here, and Morello explains why. You will hear new songs written especially for the show and Morello's collaborations with hip-hop artists Killer Mike, Big Boy, and Boots Riley. As well as country star Chris Stapleton. Cage the Elephant frontman Matt Schultz. Every time I move, every step that I take, everywhere I look, it's right in front of my face. One foot in the shadows, one foot on the brakes, one foot toward the gallows, where it's quiet and safe. Every step that I take. The show's book was written by Zaid Ayers Dorn, the son of Weather Underground radicals Bill Ayers and Bernadine Dorn. Its story, which encompasses two decades of troubled, sometimes violent activists fighting the power on Chicago's South Side, draws on themes familiar to both Dorn and Morello. Little did they know when they began work on Revolutions 5 years ago that the show would be opening in a freshly militarized Chicago. Morello grew up in the far north Chicago suburb of Libertyville, and as a biracial kid, he says he integrated the town. It was there that he discovered the guitar and vice versa and began his journey to, as he describes in thrilling detail, become an artist instead of just a musician. Can music still change the world? Have the stakes changed over the years? Does Morello hope Revolutions will activate the Goodman's traditional base or draw a new audience of Rage Against the Machine fans to the theater? How does he feel being in the audience instead of on stage as his music is being performed? What did he learn from touring and recording with Bruce Springsteen? How, as the event's musical director, did he pull off Black Sabbath's final all-star Back to the Beginning show in Birmingham, England, just 17 days before Ozzy Osbourne died? And what was the fallout when Morello told off Cubs ownership and management from a benefit concert stage back in 2014, 2 years before the team finally won the World Series? Morello, no surprise, is an especially smart, lively, and thought-provoking talker. Please enjoy this Caro Pop conversation with Tom Morello.
You gotta rise to power, rise to power, baby, you gotta rise.
So you were sitting in front of me just now. We were just watching the show. And I was wondering, what is it like for you to be seeing your music on stage without you being on stage playing it?
Yeah, it's a first. You know, I may have seen one or two Rage Against the Machine cover bands in my time, but to see a catalog of material presented in this narrative context, in this kind of beautiful Chicago multi-generational story of love and rebellion, and seeing it come to fruition and rocking the Goodman Theater, where I used to come to shows as a child, is pretty meaningful.
Did you want to get up there and pull out the guitar and just start joining in?
I selfishly am very much enjoying letting other people do the rocking. I will say, though, that one of the challenges with this show, because there is a considerable amount of musicianship required of the actors in this show, and when we were first contemplating doing it, my thought was we'll never be able to find the right people to actually be, who can play and act and sing, you know, in a compelling and convincing way. And it's going to have to be something cheesy where someone's miming playing the guitar while someone is playing it off stage. And we found the people. And that's one of the miracles of Revolutions, is that the people on stage are really playing.
Yeah, they sound really good too. Yeah. Like, how much is this thing evolving from performance to performance? And sort of notes are you taking when you're sitting there?
I have my full notebook here. I'm a type A perfectionist in that way, and just looking every day. First of all, it was in much bigger chunks earlier on. Like, here's conceptually, I think we need to have this emotional element, or that song is not working. Here's a couple of other options for songs. All of that heavy lifting is done. Now it's a matter of nuance, and, you know, both in the performances and in the music and some of the lighting cues and things like that. But it's a show that I'm tremendously proud of. And the idea was that we were not making a musical. This is not Annie Get Your Gun or Lion King. This is a big effing rock show with a story. It is a punk rock musical. It is a heavy metal musical. It is an EDM musical. It is a hip hop musical, and it's a radical theater at a time right next to Michigan Avenue, when there's troops on Michigan Avenue and protests on Michigan Avenue and Revolutions is exploding at the Goodman Theater.
Right. Yeah. Little did you know what was going to be going specifically in our city right now.
Yeah.
Because it takes a while to get something like this on stage.
Sure.
Like, how is the sort of convergence of what's actually happening in the country gone with the sort of evolution of this show?
Yeah, it's incredible. The other day I walked out of rehearsal literally into a march on Michigan Avenue. Like, just the timing was perfect, as almost as if either the show manifested the protest or the protest manifested the show. The genesis of the show was during pandemic time. Zaid Dorn, who wrote the book for the show, reached out, and we've been friends for some time. His parents, Bernadine Dorn and Bill Ayers, are the fairy godparents of my children, and we've been very close for a long time. But Zaid reached out and said, you know, I really love all of the nuances of your catalog. It's more than just some Rage Against the Machine radio staple and Audio Slave radio staples. And I'd like to try to write a show, a Chicago story, a veteran story, a multi-generational story of rebellion and generational trauma and rockingness using your catalog. I said, you can do anything you want. Let me see what that looks like when you've done it. And he wrote a beautiful, beautiful story. But so that would probably been, you know, four years ago. And then a year ago, we did a workshop here at the Goodman to just test it out. Like, what does that feel like in a room? Can these songs work, in a narrative piece? And it was pretty great. And we, you know, Leah Volokh, who's produced a lot of Broadway shows, came on board. And then the Goodman made us a part of their 100th year anniversary, which we're very, very blessed to be a part of. And, you know, there's no other city that I grew up in Libertyville, Illinois, and there's no other city that I'd have my first musical happen.
Right.
In this theater. Yeah.
No, this is an amazing place to have it happen.
Yeah.
At what point did you, like, there's some Night Watchman songs or other songs from your catalog, and then there's some new stuff as well, and a bunch of co-writes and other things. Like, at what point did you start kind of integrating the new stuff with the old stuff, and how did you figure out kind of what was still needed from you to make this work?
That's a good question, because, you know, I have a 22 album catalog, right? And so we fished around that to see what were the songs. I jokingly say that it's a jukebox musical with no hits. and in a way, that works tremendously to our advantage, because Zaid's incredible curation and Steve's direction of the play have woven these songs, sometimes from different decades, into a really coherent narrative. Then we look for where the holes are. What song maybe is not as compelling, as effective in the narratively as possible? So I wrote a bunch of new songs. We sort of picked through those. The song Untethered, which for me is one of the highlights of the show, I wrote that, I think, finished that once previews had started. You know, there's stuff that came that just arrived. Three of the songs from the show appeared in the last few weeks. I wanted to make sure that the show had absolutely enough powerful rock and roll content. It is a show, first of all, there's a lot of people in the audience that are subscribers of Goodman, come to the theater all the time. This, and they seem to be enjoying it. But I don't go to the theater all the time. I want to make a show for Rage Against the Machine fans, for Audioslave fans, for people who are pissed off about the rising tide of fascism in our country, for people who have loved ones in the military, for people who have endured or witnessed generational trauma in their families. There's a lot of different elements to the show that are kind of coming together right now. And here, we've done all of this work over the course of 4 years, and tomorrow it begins.
There you go. What's more important, sort of activating, energizing your typical Goodman theater audience, or bringing in those Rage, Audioslave, Night Watchman, everything fans, and getting them into the doors of a place that they might not go into?
Yeah, the show is a big tent in that regard.
It's a big tent.
And so I would say that it's less sort of, I would less say it's A or it's B, and that this is another, you know, sort of piece, another square in the quilt of my creative life. I didn't choose to be a guitar player. That chose me. So I'm kind of stuck doing that. Then you have to find a way to weave your convictions into your vocation. I've done that with heavy metal songs. I've done that with hip hop songs. I've done that with folk songs. I've done it with speeches at rallies. And now I'm doing it with a play at the Goodman.
You have a quote in there from Jimi Hendrix. If there's anything in this world to be changed, it will only be changed through music.
Yeah.
Do you believe that?
I think that that's one thing that is an axiom, is that there has never been a successful social movement in this country that has not had a great soundtrack. From the union anthems of the early 20th century to the civil rights movement, to the anti-war movement, to the, you know, the bricks thrown through Starbucks windows, you know, in the early 2000s, to a lot of Rage Against the Machine jams pumping in the streets at the anti-Trump, anti-ICE, anti-fascist demonstrations going on, you know, yesterday, today, and tomorrow.
Right. Do you think the power is the same now as it was, the power of music, the power of protest, or is there, I don't know, like an evolution that needs to happen to be effective?
I would say, I mean, I wouldn't ghettoize it like that. I'd say that music is, a culture is one component to both reflect the world and change the world, right? Like I was not politicized by music, but music made me, you know, courage is contagious. It made me feel that I was less alone in my beliefs and my convictions. I grew up in Libertyville, right? But it was Public Enemy and The Clash that made me realize there were people in Staten Island and on the, you know, the Westway in London that felt exactly the same way that I did about the world. And hopefully in a show like Revolutions, that can happen in our audience on a nightly basis.
Right. And to go back again to some of the new songs you wrote. So you have one, what was it?
Untethered is brand new.
Right. The War Inside is one you wrote with Chris Stapleton.
Yeah.
There's one with Big Boy, you got Boots Riley.
Yeah,
how did these collaborations happen?
Sure. Well, these collaborations happened over time. I've always been open to collaboration. Originally, I sort of thought I'd be in Rage Against the Machine for the rest of my life and we'd make 25 albums. That didn't be the case, wasn't the case, and I'm a tremendously prolific person. So if there's a studio door, I will walk through it. And it's been those collaborations with everyone from, you know, Paul McCartney to Wu-Tang Clan, from Pete Seeger to Sepultura, that have enhanced my understanding of music, my own creativity, and have built this pretty diverse catalog over the course of three decades that we were able to fish around in to find the right songs for the right show for the right time.
Right. Well, in the show, I mean, there's a great diversity of types of music in it. I mean, you got your hip hop, your metal hop, whatever you would call it. You got some power ballads and you know, soulful stuff, kind of countryish stuff. So you cover a lot of ground.
Yeah.
I mean, has that always been your kind of mindset, that you just kind of want to contain all these multitudes?
Yeah, I think, it's been a journey. Like, I grew up loving heavy music. First, it was metal. It was 7-Eleven, parking lot, hard rock, Midwestern jams. And then the next music that appealed to me that was hard was punk rock music. And then hip hop was harder than that, and I like that. And those were kind of like my wheelhouse for a while. It wasn't until my early 30s where I discovered that folk music is as heavy as anything in the Metallica catalog when it's done right. Whether it's Springsteen's Nebraska records, some of the early Dylan records, Phil Oaks, the Joe Hill songs, Pete Seeger, that sometimes the three chords and the truth with the right lyrical couplet could be absolutely as devastating as anything with a wall of Marshall Stacks. And I've really leaned into that. You know, I've got like five Night Watchman records. And so this musical, Revolutions, is able to to me, it feels like I sit there watching it now and it feels like these songs were written for this show, even though they've been written for a lot of disparate reasons over the course of some time.
And what was the conscious decision not to go with the quote unquote hits? Because, I mean, you have a lot of pretty popular songs.
Yeah. I mean, I thought there's something that I don't love about there's an exploitative nature that I don't love about some of the jukebox musicals with a capital J, capital M, where it's like, hey, we have this huge catalog. How do we work the catalog on Spotify and boost the ticket sales of, you know, Britney Spears or whatever it is that I want to stay well away from. And I like the fact that the songs in the show, you know, if you're a diehard fan of Tom Morello, you'll be familiar with some of them. But I like the fact that these songs work wholly independently of the records that they come from, rather than the musical being dependent on people's familiarity with radio songs, which are, in the case of a lot of jukebox musicals, are just jammed in there because of the fact that they were hits, and you have to find some dopey narrative to weave around them.
Right. I do think Mamma Mia, Here We Go Again is about the funniest sequel title since The Neverending Story 2. I think those are the two funniest sequels. But not yet. Here We Go Again. It's another one. It's the same damn ABBA songs.
Yeah. Commerce calls.
Did you go on any kind of, I don't know, deep dive into like rock on theater stages, either before you were doing this or after, to sort of see like what works and what seems cheesy?
No, I know what works and what seems cheesy in my mind. But I will say that first of all, one of my favorite musicals of all time is Jesus Christ Superstar, right? Where I think it's very, very, very effective, right? But so when we began this, there was when we started rehearsals for this show that's going to open tomorrow night, there was a learning curve. And I had to sit in that room and we wrote on the wall, the room right next door, like big letters on the wall, like, this is not a musical with quotation marks around it. And these are the filters that we're going to look at everything we do through, these filters. The first filter was the punk rock filter. It's like, when a punk rock fan comes to this show, if there's anything that seems corny, we don't do that. Then there's the heavy metal filter. That filter is, we're putting on a kick-ass rock and roll show with a story. It's got to feel like, it's got to sound like that in the room. It's got to feel like that in the room. The third one is, there's a hip-hop filter. It has to, the show has to have swag. It has to feel like it has emanated, the themes and the charisma of some of the performers have to seem like they've arisen from the streets. And then after that, it's radical theater. It's not a musical. Like, we've got a radical point of view. We've got radical music in it to radicalize our audience if we do the job.
And the Goodman was just fine with that. They're like, yeah, no, put all these filters on there.
We should
see
what we wanted to do.
You know, we got these nice
one or two things that we had to have some discussions about that might not have made it to opening night.
Yeah, I'm wondering sort of what sort of got cut for the cheese reasons and what got cut for the radical reasons.
I was very concerned about there being a musical dance element to it, you know, and originally there was like some more choreography stuff that was proposed that I felt just didn't feel like this is going to be cool. And then on the other hand, and this will manifest at some point in some iteration, is the show was not supposed to, there's a version of the show that will not just occur on the stage, and it will not just occur during the time from the set time. Like, we've had some grand designs about lobbies and front of house and streets outside and things like that. And that, you know, that might have been a bridge too far for.
You're trying a little bit more of like getting out in the audience and getting the
audience. Yeah,
wow. Getting down on Dearborn
and some other stuff. Yeah.
So this still might happen during this run or just other.
I'm
incarnation.
Always pushing. There may be a guerrilla version of that. It's hard to say.
Better to
ask for forgiveness than permission. Right?
There you go. Were you? I mean, I know you're not in Chicago all the time, but were you here when they did the recent revival of The Who's Tommy? And like,
I wasn't, I didn't get to see it though. We were working when that was up here.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. I think it was when we were doing the workshop.
Because you're talking about all the different, you know, like it's not a musical, it's a this, it's that. And it's like, part of me was thinking, and it's a concept album, because that's kind of, it's a rock opera, but without the opera part of it.
Yeah. I mean, well, at one point, I mean, this, from your lips to God's ears, that there will be this material in the order that we do it feels to me like it is a very sort of compelling concept record now.
I was wondering if that's sort of the next step.
It's not in the works. Right now, we're just trying to get to opening night.
Well, and also, like, I was wondering whether, like, you sort of have a set of songs in it, but whether, like, the order has changed, the narrative's kind of been, you know, like, no, you know, we're going to put this one at the end of Act 2 instead of in the middle of Act 1 or something like that.
Yeah, there's been the opening song, Keep Going, we added maybe 4 days ago to the show. I just thought, I have some notes I want to sort of even expand that more, is the, you know, it's the generational ghosts that the main character is hearing in his head that echo back far beyond his father's first tour of duty. So back into antebellum times and beyond that.
Is there like one major note that you're still hoping will be incorporated in this as it goes on?
Oh, that's a good question. I have gotten most of those out of my system. I got some small ones here, but the, you know, continuing the biggest challenge in a room like this, you know, we had a PA in this room that was set for the Crucible, not for, you know, the United Center.
Right.
And it's like, it's got to feel like you're in the United Center at a big kick-ass Rage Against the Machine show. And so we had to bring in a bunch of stuff for that. That was like sort of the main note, was like, we can't budge one inch on the power of the sound of this show and the music.
Yeah, it's interesting because at Chicago Shakes, they did Sunny Afternoon, the Kinks jukebox musical. And they definitely turned up the amps more than for your typical show at Chicago Shakespeare or something like that. And this is another one where, you know, if you want earplugs, those of you listening, you're in Chicago, you can get earplugs. And so, you know, depending on what you're...
Earplugs with the playbill, which is a ringing endorsement already before it was, you're just walking into the door.
But it's interesting to me, like, I'm guessing that when Hair premiered, you know, maybe they didn't have to hand out earplugs. I don't know that we've reached this other level of people understand that the volume of a rock concert, and in this case, you know, a rock hip hop heavy, like, is just going to be louder, and you need that volume to have that visceral experience.
When done right, it should be dangerous both to your earbuds and to fascism.
Right. And Your Anger is a Gift is a quote from your first album. Is that, like, how does that apply to what you're doing right now?
Well, I mean, did you see the show?
That's what I'm saying. We were tying it together. Chris, my producer, who was pointing out, they were on this theme from their first album.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, some of those themes are eternal. And, you know, if there has been one thread through all 22 albums and Goodman plays, is that the world is not going to change itself, and that is up to you. And the show is called Revolutions for a reason. There's more than one kind of revolution. There's more than one way to change the world, but that each of us are agents of history, and that history is not something that happens. It is not something that's in books. It's something that we are currently engaged in or abstaining from right now.
And you've been doing this for a long time. Do you feel...
I have.
Do you feel more... You know, we were born the same month, by the way.
Really?
We're both... May. I wasn't going to mention the year, but yes, it's true.
It is what it is.
It is true. Three months after Ed Sullivan, the Beatles. We missed that, but do you feel now more or less optimistic than you did when you started about the ability to get things to change in a positive direction?
Yeah. I think that my sentiments about that are echoed in the show, that it's just the road. You know what I mean? And you pick it up and you carry it as far as you can. You use all of your power that you can muster to carry it as far as you can towards justice, towards peace, towards democracy, towards freedom, towards anti-racism, anti-homophobia, et cetera, you know, during your time. And you put it down, and then hopefully somebody carries it further. And there's a famous Howard Zinn quote that you can't be neutral on a moving train, and that is manifest in the show as well, is that when there is something, whether it's police brutality, whether it's a governmental authoritarianism that is on the rise, that is moving in a certain direction, there's three things you can do. One is you can help move it in the bad direction. You can turn in your neighbors, etc. You can be a racist person. Two, you can push against it. You can do whatever you can in your line of work, on the streets, etc., to try to slow it, to stop it, to turn it around the other way. Or you can sit on the sidelines and allow it to happen. Those are the three things you can do. But there are three things you do, but there are only two outcomes. It happens or it doesn't. And so the way that I've always looked at I'm stuck being a effing guitar player. And so I've had to try to find ways to bend that career so that it accurately reflects my constitutional point of view and the things that I believe in. And sometimes that, you know, sometimes it bubbles under the surface, sometimes it erupts in albums or in shows or in musicals at the Goodman.
I mean, the forces against this kind of revolution right now are, part of the strategy is to make people give up and to make people feel like the bad things that you're seeing happen that you don't want to happen are inevitable. Resistance is futile, you know, and there's sort of like a sort of sense of flooding the zone and wear you down. And so your message is you just got to, that doesn't matter. You just got to get your head down and just barrel ahead and do what needs to be done. Because what choice
also,
do you have?
And also be reminded that the idea that you can't change the world, the propaganda that you can't change the world, that is not new either. Like at one point it was never, the women would never get the right to vote. Right. You know, African-Americans in the South would never get the right to vote. The Berlin Wall would never come down. Apartheid would never end. Those are things that were in their time. Like there's no reason to even fight against that. There's no chance that that's going to happen. And all of those things did change because people, no different than anyone listening to this. Here's the thing. Like the world is only going to change if you and I make that happen. That seems daunting. But the good news is when the world has changed in progressive or radical or revolutionary ways, it has been changed by people with no more power, courage, money, creativity than anyone listening right now. It's people, they stand up in their place and time because they've had enough. That's how it changes.
Anger is a gift.
What was the first song you ever wrote?
First song I ever wrote I'll start with the first song I ever wrote that is representative. It was called Salvador Death Squad Blues.
Oh, I love that.
And it was, I got the Clash record, right? The London Calling was my first Clash record. Somebody brought it into.
It's a good one to start with.
Yeah, it was a good one. I thought it was a heavy metal record because the guy was smashing his bass on the cover of it. And then it turned out it was not a heavy metal record and surprisingly was better than a lot of my heavy metal records. But that was the music that made me realize, I thought that if you were a musician, you had to write about groupies and the devil. And if you were an activist, that was a completely separate lane where you could be about justice and anti-imperialism and whatnot. And the Clash made me realize, oh, hold on one second. But you can rock hard, look cool, and say what's in your heart in a way that's unapologetic and still be great. So I tried my hand writing a song called Salvador Death Squad Blues in my Libertyville High School punk rock band called The Electric Sheep.
Could you still play it?
Yeah, I probably could. I think it was like a blues jam. So yeah, it was a blues in G.
And when you were learning guitar, I mean you're someone who gets like a great number of sounds and you're really innovative obviously with the guitar. At what point did you sort of look at the instrument, and maybe it was the whole time, as like, this isn't something for me to like learn how to do this chord or this chord. Yeah. It's for me to like get these sounds out.
Yeah, yeah. Well, the first it began that way, and then it drifted far apart from that when it came back to that. So I took a couple of guitar lessons at Rigoni Music on Milwaukee Avenue in Libertyville. I wanted to learn Detroit Rock City by Kiss and Black Dog by Led Zeppelin. And they wanted to teach me how to tune the guitar and the C major scale. And it seemed like a huge waste of time. So I put the guitar down for 4 years and just sat in the closet. And my mom, Mary Morrell, would be like, we blew $50 on that guitar and it sits in the closet. I picked it up when I got the Sex Pistols cassette. And I went to the drama club of Libertyville High School and I said, a punk band is, I didn't know how to play a note or a chord on the guitar, not one note or chord. I said, a punk band is forming. I'm the guitar player because I have a guitar. Anybody who wants to join, please raise your hand. No experience required. So a couple hands went up. And so I thought, I'm never going to learn nothing from nobody, because that learning stuff is what made me want to not play music, and just being excited about being in a band made me want to do it. Then I spent my 8 hours a day practicing scales and chords and learning Ozzy Osbourne songs and this, that, and the other, and became one more shredder in a world of 80s heavy metal shredders. And there was a revelatory moment. It was very, very much in the early days of Rage Against the Machine. We were opening up for two bands at a lousy college show in the San Fernando Valley. Each of these bands had a tremendously technically skilled guitar player. And I was the third one. I was the opening technically skilled guitar player. I was like, well, it felt like we're three hamsters on the same stupid wheel. Like I watched them play and went, nobody cares. I watched the other guy, I'm like, nobody cares. So hold on one second. Maybe nobody cares. And I began spending my 8 hours a day practicing the eccentricities in my playing and deconstructing the instrument. And that was the moment where I went from being a musician to being an artist. Being a musician requires technique. Being an artist requires ideas. And all of a sudden I was like, okay, I have an idea. And that is to throw, or I've got the technique in my back pocket, but the electric guitar is a brand new instrument on the relatively new instrument on the planet. It's a piece of wood with some wires and some electronics that can be manipulated in a lot of ways that are different than Eddie Van Halen or Chuck Berry or Keith Richards. And so if I made a mistake, I would play that mistake 16 times in a row and make it the cornerstone of a song. I started, rather than trying to ape Randy Rhoads and Eddie Van Halen, I started trying to ape police helicopters and animals at the zoo.
Wow, yeah.
And was practicing that. Now, if you do that, you might not sound like a helicopter or like an animal at a zoo, but if you practice that 8 hours a day, you no longer start sounding like other guitar players. And that's where I, all of a sudden, I was the DJ in Rage Against the Machine. And the combination of the big Zeppelin-esque, Sabbath-esque riffs with this R2-D2, you know, old McDonald had a farm guitar sounds, all of a sudden felt like, okay, this is my voice on the instrument.
What was the first kind of customization you did to a guitar?
It wasn't customization. It was the repurposing.
Okay.
It was a repurposing. And this actually happened in college. So my roommate was a big opera fan and he hated heavy metal. He was driven nuts by my Marshall half stack in my room. And at the time, the Eddie Van Halen guitar was the coolest guitar on the planet. Everybody had one because it only had one knob, volume. And that was pretty kick-ass and cool because that's all you need. I didn't have that guitar. I had a guitar with a bunch of knobs and a toggle switch and a bunch of crap on it. It was super not cool. So one day I was messing around with a wah-wah pedal and the toggle switch. And if you turn one of the volume knobs to zero and the other to 10 and toggle between those two pickups, it's an on-off switch, like
right.
And then I was manipulating the with the wah-wah pedal, and my roommate comes barging in, furious, like, "You bought a fucking keyboard too? You're gonna drive me nuts." I said, "Did that sound like a keyboard?"
Oh,
that's
nice.
That's interesting. And so then that became one of the things that I practiced was that. And it felt like that's not on anybody's record. But it only came to the surface. It was a very, very crucial moment of failure that allowed me to find myself, my voice on the instrument. I was in a band before Rage Against the Machine called Lockup. We had a deal on Geffen Records. And I was a junior member of that band, and I'd never met anybody that had a record deal before. So, you know, everybody in Libertyville thinks you're like a millionaire. I'm living like with six roommates in one room. But we were like, we have to be successful. And I moved out here. I got a record deal. We did everything the producer told us. Everything. They smoothed the band down. They took out the heaviest riffs. My weird guitar sounds. There were no weird guitar sounds on the radio, so we better not have them on your record. I was like, okay, well, these are the experts. They know. We got dropped from the label, $200 in our pockets. And I was 27, and I had had my grab at the brass ring. I had missed the brass ring. I was never going to be a rock star. I was never going to make records, but I was a musician. I'd failed to do those things, but I was still a musician, so I might as well play music that I like. And I sat down and wrote the riffs for the first Rage Against the Machine record. When it came time to play the guitar solos, I played what I fucking wanted to play, which was R2-D2 sounds, and with the toggle switch and all that, and that was the music that connected. And you can extrapolate whatever lesson you want from.
And if I'm allowed to make a comment about the Lockup, when I saw the name of your first album, it
might be the worst title in the history of Western music. It's called Something Bitchin' This Way Comes. Wasn't my idea.
I was just like, whoa. It's like, you got better.
Yeah. So. You got better. I had a little bit more say in the Rage records than I did in the Lockup record.
I'd read that when you were like, you did.
That was a lot.
Yeah, yeah. I'm glad I was able to affirm that for you, by the way.
Yeah,
just so you, I know you appreciate that. You know, I feel like Stuart Smalley. You can do it. It's okay.
Keep it up, man.
I'd read somewhere that you were in a cover band called Nebula that you were the singer for that.
That was when I was 13. That was when I failed as a guitar player because I couldn't play the guitar. Before my voice changed.
And you're singing on the Night Watchman records.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I mean, it's terrific. So,
thanks. Yeah.
Did you ever think of, like, I'm going to be the front man and be the shredder and the singer?
No,
or was it always like,
yeah,
I need to
well,
do...
I was a singer in Nebula when I was 13. It was before my voice changed.
So
I was able
to go,
baby, 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 baby. And then the rich milk chocolate baritone you hear now is one that it was not maybe as commercially read. You couldn't sing REO Speedwagon songs with the voice that I currently have now. But yeah, I didn't start singing on albums. And what a all you musicians out there, what a liberating thing it is. You're a guitar player, keyboard player, drummer, sing to, write your own songs. Have an independent voice where you're not wholly dependent on the mercurial nature of lead singers. But no, I started writing my own songs. This was at the right around the formation of Audioslave. And on Audio Slave was playing like hockey arenas, and on nights off, I would go to open mic nights and do my night watchman sets, sign up, sit there, wait with a, you know, espresso machine in the background to play my three songs with the same kind of conviction that I've ever done anything in my entire life, and realized, okay, this is a very, very important second act for me, where I'm really finding another, I'm not dependent on guitar heroism to express myself as an artist.
Yeah, Audio Slave is so interesting because it's really basically Rage Against the Machine with a different frontman, but it's a totally different band
because of that. Yeah,
like, and
yeah.
It just shows you kind of how like chemistry.
100%. It is. And that's what it is. Yeah. I mean, with Audio, it's funny too. It's not just the musical chemistry; it's the personal chemistry. And I insisted at the beginning of Audio Slave that Audio Slave be a more political band than Rage Against the Machine. I thought that Rage Against the Machine fell short in a lot of ways in the world of activism that we didn't like manifest in the streets and at the shows as much as we could have. Said, well, this, we're going to do it right. So he used to bully the poor guys in Audio Slave. We rehearsed all week, but one day a week I would bring in an activist organization to like lecture us about, I don't know, animal rights or this, that, and the other. And after a while, someone put their hand on my shoulder and went, we don't want to do this anymore. And I realized that in order for a band to be great, a band has to be authentic. And in order for that band to be the best thing it could be, it's not me shoehorning it into one person's vision of it. And it's a very important dichotomy. That there's the reason bands are great is because of chemistry. You create something together that none of you could do alone, something unexpected.
Right.
The reason solo artists are great is purity, is you create something that is undiluted by other people's visions of how it should be. And I've tried to have the best of both worlds throughout my 22 album.
When you were growing up and, you know, getting into music, were you into Springsteen or like where?
I discovered that way late.
Yeah. Tell me about your Springsteen evolution where you're ending up, you know, I mean, you're obviously touring with him. You're on Wrecking Ball a bit, High Hopes a lot.
Yeah. So I discovered Springsteen very, very late. I did not understand what kind of artist he was. He was sort of in the back. I didn't have older brothers. My mom didn't introduce me to music. So I found music on my own. It was Kiss and then whatever bands were in the magazines. The Kiss was on the cover. I liked those. Later, I found the Sex Pistols and the Clash, etc. And my introduction to Bruce Springsteen was kind of the world's introduction to him was the Born in the USA record, which was the Dancing in the Dark video, which is not the purest expression of the breadth and depth of that artist. And he was a pop star like a bunch of other pop stars. But then I saw there was an HBO special of the Amnesty International tour. It was him and Sting and Yusan Duor and maybe Tracy Chapman or whatever. And they were in Argentina. And I thought, I was watching this at, you know, home with some friends. And I was like, wow, Bruce Springsteen's headlining this thing? I'm like, probably should have been Peter Gabriel or somebody, you know, who knows who's good like that.
There you go.
And I watched it. And by the end of his set, I had cried. I had jumped around in my living room with 100,000 Argentinians. And I said, hold on. Like, I might have had this one wrong. And I went out and I bought the cassettes for Darkness on the Edge of Town in Nebraska. And they were life-changing. I'm like, holy shit. Like, this guy, did he grow up in Libertyville? And it was the same existential dread that I felt every time I mowed the lawn. Things are not all right in a particular way that guy deeply understands. And I became, you know, I'm the number one Springsteen fan, and playing with him was pretty extraordinary.
So what did you learn from that experience of, you know, on the road in the studio
that? Yeah. Well, we were friends for about 8 years before we ever played together. Right. And the first time we played together was 2008 in Anaheim. We did Ghost of Tom Joad because, you know, he's got the acoustic version. Rage had covered it with like a bombastic riff rock version. And the melding of the two was one that was, you know, at the end of that, we looked at each other and like we both like, uh-oh, something just happened here. That was very, very unexpected for the E Street Band and for myself, and played together on and off over the next 6 years. You know, what I learned from it is that the work ethic, there are certain apex performers in different areas, and whether it's a Michael Jordan or whether it's a Tom Brady, Bruce Springsteen is one of those guys, right? That there's a commitment to the art and to excellence and to greatness across all fronts that you really feel in everything that guy does, you know, from diet to, you know, I'll give you that. We were playing in Melbourne, playing a soccer stadium, 60, 80,000 people. And we had played 3+ hours. And we had played the hits. And we had wrung every ounce of sweat from the audience. It's a great night where people are going to go home and go, this was the greatest show I've ever seen. We're maybe 3:10 into this thing. And Bruce says, without a hint of irony, are you ready to get this show started?
Ha!
And then another 50 minutes of banger. You're like, you just can't believe it. You can't believe it. And that's something I would always take when I was on stage with him during Born to Run. I'd always give myself 10 to 15 seconds of pure, I would just turn and look over there and watch Bruce, me, in close proximity to Bruce Springsteen playing Born to Run in some stadium, go like, right on.
That's, you know, I saw one of the concerts they did in the, I think it was the 2004 election, and it was Springsteen and REM, and he was in Philadelphia, and I remember everyone got on stage for Born in the Run at the end of it, and I mentioned this because I talked to Mike Mills from REM, and I said my vivid memory of that song was you just grinning, like you just being up there playing Born to Run, and I never thought of like REM and Springsteen in the same universe even, but it was just like, joy.
No, I love playing with him, and just that commitment, you see like fans in the front row in Perth and Peoria, you know, who and they're so excited to be there and it's so meaningful to them, and they're not as excited to be there and it's not as meaningful to them as it is to Bruce Springsteen.
As someone who's so aware of band chemistry, is there any sort of trick to coming into something this, you know, an outfit that's been around and is as tight as the E Street Band?
You see this one coming. Sure there is. Like my the E Street Band had been a great live band for 40 years without me. And so my goal was just don't make it worse. Honestly, just like don't make it worse. On the last tour we did together, the US tour, we played 34 dates, 182 different songs, individual songs in 34 dates. So for me,
That's a lot of songs.
For a guy like
For listeners out there, that's a lot of songs.
I mean, with Rage Against the Machine, we have like 3 records of original material. The set list we played in 92 is not dramatically different than the set list we played in 2022 at Madison Square Garden, but with Bruce, like the stated idea was people are not coming to hear your hits. People are not coming to, you know, see you be handsome. People are coming to see you be present and in the moment and create something that is a unique experience on that night. And let me tell you, you are mother flipping present when you have literally no idea what the name. Sometimes he would change the first song in the set. Like you walk on stage, you look at that set list, and instead he barks something else. You're like, okay, and we're off.
Wow. You know, as someone who sometimes, you know, follows the music world without actually having to being able to get to all these legendary concerts. One of the concerts that people seem to love this year was the Back to the Beginning show, which was basically the last Black Sabbath show. Sure. And I didn't realize till I was like preparing to talk to you that you were the musical director of that.
That's correct.
So how did that happen and how'd you pull it off?
Sure. Well, I've known Ozzy and Sharon for some time and was greatly surprised and kind of overwhelmed when they asked me to do that. You know, Sharon said, I was talking with Ozzy and we're going to do one last Sabbath show, one last Ozzy show at their hometown, in the hometown stadium. And would you be the curator of it? I said, I will. That's wild. I mean, heavy metal is the music that made me love music. And Black Sabbath created that genre. Ozzy Osbourne is the artist who brought the guitarist Randy Rhoads into the world. That was the poster that was on my wall when I was practicing 8 hours a day. It's the reason why I am the musician that I am, because all of the other rock star guitar players that I admired were rock stars first, and they played great guitar. Randy Rhoads was a musician first. My uncle Carlo was in the Chicago Symphony Orchestra for 40 years. I remember him walking around the house with his violin. I was like, that's a musician. And I did not see that in, you know, Angus Young is awesome, but I wouldn't say that the first thing that he is a musician. He's a rock star. He's the greatest. But right. But Randy Rhoads was a guy that when he was on tour with Ozzy playing heavy metal shows, on nights off, he would take classical guitar lessons in whatever town they were in. There was a commitment to the instrument that was really appealing to me. So I owed not just a great artistic debt to Black Sabbath and Ozzy, but like a life debt. My firstborn son is named Rhoads Morello. All right. So when they asked me to do this, I said, I'm going to take this really seriously. And the goal is to make this the greatest day in the history of heavy metal and to create a day that is as important as the artists that we are feating. And I will say that there's never, you know, in retrospect, there certainly has never been a day like this where you take an artist of that stature who's that meaningful and have them feel the love of the bands that they've created. Metallica, you know, everybody who was on that, some of the hugest bands in the world played on that stage and said, we love you and appreciate you. The fans in their hometown, it's a 20-minute walk from the door of the stadium to Ozzy Osbourne's childhood home. From his backyard, he could hear the soccer games that he didn't have enough money to get into, right? So the town that gave birth to Sabbath and Ozzy and metal got to show how much they love them. Millions of fans around the world, whether it's on the pay-per-view or the YouTube thing, the whole world got to say thank you and we love you at this last show. And then the thing that's different about this show is they got to give that love back. All four of them were alive. All four of them were on stage.
They got Bill Ward back.
All four of them got to say, thank you, we love you too. And then it was done. 2 weeks later, Ozzy passed. So the weight of that day and the importance of that day, it was pretty special. And it's just an honor to be a part of it.
I mean, obviously, Ozzy was fragile at that point, but he also still could sing the stuff, which was part of what made it so moving for everyone.
Yeah.
Did you realize like how tenuous everything was with him at that point?
I mean, Ozzy's been like kind of not okay for a long time.
There you go.
A long time. And he did a week after the show, he did a signing in Birmingham. You know, so it wasn't like, oh, I just got wheeled to the stage and now I'm going to pass. He was like still active, 7 days after the show, and it was a tragedy pass. But what a legacy and, you know.
An amazing swan song, too.
An amazing swan song.
And you got to put it together. Kudos, as they say. Yeah. For Revolutions, part of what's interesting is the sort of generational idea of creating values and sort of role models. And you have female role models, male role models that are people struggling with those. Like, did that come from you also, or was that more?
Zaid wrote the book, and he certainly has that in his family. His mother and father were the leaders of the Weather Underground.
Absolutely.
Spent years on the FBI's most wanted list, and so he's able to write from a very personal perspective of how that affected him, the pluses and minuses of what was handed down to him, the good and the bad. He's also familiar with my story and my father, my great uncle was Jomo Kenyatta, Kenya's first president. My dad was part of the anti-colonial movement there, and my mom, Mary Morello, a radical high school teacher in a conservative town. So the sort of my story helped inform, but he had a lot of firsthand knowledge of people who were Black Panthers, Black Liberation Army, Weather Underground, and raised in a generation of their kids and what it means to have that legacy and that burden. And I think that anybody, you don't think it's not necessarily exclusive to political parents, is the good and the bad that's handed down from the next generation. How much of your sins will be your own and how much will be in your DNA.
Right. I mean, you were raised by your mother, who's awesome, Mary Morello. She's, 102 now?
102. She just turned 102.
But yeah, I remember covering her 30 years ago at the Tribune. And she, I don't know how to ask this without sounding really broad and obvious, but like, how much did that shape you just being raised by a strong woman like that?
Sure. Well, it insulated me from a lot of the bad in the world that leaks into people and undermines their foundation. I was literally the only Black person in an all-white town, according to our real estate agent. I integrated Libertyville, Illinois, right? And, in the 60s, there was, a lot of prejudice and whatnot. There was a noose in my family's garage at one time and whatnot. But I always felt this from the love that I got from not just from my mom, but her parents and my aunt and uncle. I always felt that they valued me, and I felt very loved, and I felt like there was this kind of basis of, no matter what happens to me outside that door, I know that I've got a home where I matter and I mean something in a way that is very, that is sustaining, that's sustained. Like, I felt like I'm going to be okay, and the world can come at me, but I've got this as a really solid foundation. And I didn't realize how unique that was till I got out in the world, and you meet people in bands who have absolutely the opposite condition, where they're greatly undermined in a lot of ways that didn't have that kind of rock to lean on.
When you go home, are you still like writing songs? Do you have like another project?
Untethered, which made it into this, is actually being torn from my next solo. I'm working on, this will be my first Tom Morello rock solo record. I've made folk solo records, collaborative solo records, and this solo record in that I still do Rob riffs from my son Roman, who is he outstripped me in a lot of different ways, and he's in a very sweet spot. So I bring him on tour. He's very charming. He can shred his ass off, and he's got some great riffs. So I'll be using some of his riffs, but I'm making a big rock record. I leave a few days after opening night, this like Thursday, for a Canadian tour. And then I'm back playing the Vic in Chicago in November. And there's kind of an East Coast rock tour, and then India at the end of the year. And then next year is a lot busier.
Do you have a solo band?
Yeah, the Freedom Fighter Orchestra that I played with for many years.
So it's the same people you've been playing with for a while. But it's going to come out as Tom Morello.
Yeah.
What's the name of the album?
To Be Determined.
That's not a great title.
I think
you could do better than that.
Something Bitch in This Way comes part two. Mamma Mia part two.
Something Bitch in This Way came. It'll be sort of a retrospective. You'll just redo the lockup songs.
I'll just redo the lockup songs. We have covered lockup songs. We've covered Electric Sheep songs.
There you go.
Though I still have to do Salvador Death Squad Blues Live. I haven't done that in decades. So.
I saw you in 2014 at the Hot Stove Cool Music Foundation show with Metro. It was for like the Cubs charities and all of this stuff. And you had a bit of a message for Cubs ownership at the time.
It was a controversial evening.
And I was wondering kind of what, you were kind of telling Tom Ricketts, like, basically pony up. I mean, it worked out a couple of years later, but I'm sort of wondering what happened with your relationship with the Cubs from that. If they were afterwards like, dude. And of course, I'm asking
afterwards,
you this thing.
They certainly were, dude.
This, of course, the afternoon after they just got eliminated.
Okay, so here's the thing. Like, I am a lifelong Chicago Cubs fan, and Chicago Cubs fans have been taken advantage of our entire history because we fill the stadium every day, no matter what quality team is on the field, right? And, you know, I'm not getting any younger. Once I had kids, I had provisions written into my will what those kids had to do if I had passed and the Cubs finally won the World Series. It is a talk about generational burdens. Okay, that team was a generational burden on me and my family. So I had had enough. So I had written up like a 10-point program of these are the things the Chicago Cubs need to do in order to win the World Series. I need to get personally involved. I'm very type A, as you might have noticed, right? It's a charity show. I'm invited by, you know, the Ricketts family and, you know, all of them. And it's with Cheap Trick and some other bands right now. And we're playing some Blues Brothers covers, some Night Watchman songs. It's a nice time. And then I stop. Everybody's just there, boozy. But, you know, there's some billionaires and somebody having a nice time. And then here comes Debbie Downer with his, here's where you've been racist. Here's where you've been. Like, you ask the guy from Rage Against the Machine. The guy from Rage Against the Machine might show up, okay? So, but it is a heartfelt Cubs. It is from someone who loves this
absolutely
team and who it matters to me, and I feel that I'm not so afterwards, you know, the GM, first of all, he comes on stage like, give me the hook, because he has no idea how long I'm going to go on. I did have an end to it, but afterwards he and I shared a bottle of Jameson, and he explained to me that this is different. Like, I'm going to build a team from scratch.
Wait, this is you and Theo, or are you
me
and Tom Ricketts?
This is me and Theo. It's me and Theo. And he comes into the dressing room and he explains to me, like, this is, he's got graphs, like, we got a board up, and he's telling me, you don't want to spend this money for a 27-year-old player. You want to. He's explaining to me like the money ball of it all. Right. He's money balling. This is how I did it here. This is my plan to do it here. We became very close friends. Our emails. I have the email exchange where I said, "Okay, you're making me think that you might be onto something here. Tell me who's going to be on the field." He guaranteed me the Cubs would win the World Series. He said, "I guarantee you." He looked me in the eye. I said,
And they did two years later, and I said, who
will be on the field when the Cubs win the World Series? And he sent me that I could bring up the text.
Wow.
And it's about 80% accurate. But the one thing he did say during that, the confrontational part of that was like, you don't want to like piss off the organization. Like, you want a space on the, you know, in the parade. I said, Theo, I earned a space in the parade long before you were born. like the tears I've cried long before when you were in diapers. Like, and Tom Ricketts has always been very, very gracious. Whenever they've played in LA, he always invites me and my family to come to the shows. It's been very, very, I didn't get a ring though. Some of my friends.
Did you get in the parade though?
I was at every game though.
Okay,
we were taking care of it. And a generational burden has been relieved. Like, for example, I was watching the game last night where the Cubs were eliminated, and, you know, I would have loved for them to win another chip, and it would have been nice, but I can go about my day rather than the existential dread that I used to feel when they were eliminated.
Yeah.
So it all worked out.
I could probe
into it. And my speech, I'm not sure that it didn't have nothing to do with it.
See, there you go. You lit a fire.
Aroldis Chapman, you know what his walk-on music was? Rage Against the Machine's Wake Up.
There you
go.
So
I'm waiting for that ring in the mail.
Well, thank you so much, Tom. It was really great
to
talk to you.
No,
absolutely. And, I might have to swing by and see the show at the end of the run or later in the run just to sort of see if you guys are tweaking it at all. But it was really great.
Yeah,
and I hope that you're able to light a fire under a lot of people.
Yeah, so I appreciate it. Thank you very much for having me.
That's all for episode 198 of Caro Pop. Thanks so much to Tom Morello for speaking with us on the eve of the premiere of his punk metal hip-hop musical, Revolutions. It runs through November 16th at Chicago's Goodman Theater, and tickets are available at goodmantheater.org. That's theater with an R-E. After the premiere, the ever-active Morello is embarking on a Canadian tour. He'll be presenting a night of stories and music in Oakville, Ontario, on Saturday, October 18th, with 14 more tour stops through November 6th. Then he's back in the USA to kick off a series of electric full band shows at Chicago's Vic Theater on November 13th, with dates to follow in Washington, D.C., Boston, Brooklyn, Manhattan, Atlantic City, New Jersey, and Ledyard, Connecticut. If you happen to be in India in December, he'll be there too. Tour information is available on his website, tommorello.com. You also can follow him on Instagram, Facebook, TikTok, X, and Blue Sky. Caro Pop is produced, and in this case, recorded by Chris Swake, a true audio slave. Thanks to all who support Caro Pop. If you'd like to throw something into the Caro Pop kitty, we'd be much appreciative. You can give $24 or whatever you'd like at caropop.com. Thanks so much for listening and being here. I'm Mark Caro. Please follow Caro Pop on the so-called socials at Caro Popcast. You can follow me as well at Mark Caro at M-A-R-K-C-A-R-O. Please share this episode, subscribe, tell your friends, and tune in again next week for another Caro Pop conversation. Thanks.